Okay. How many of you have ever been swimming from, hold on, hear me out, from a beach? Have you hand up? And you've been to one of those beaches where it sort of goes out and it's kind of shallow and it's shallow and then suddenly it's like zoom and it sort of drops off. Like where people go surfing, often have that. You will probably have noticed that that's the moment at which we arrived in the last few days with your preparation for this class, the covenant with Moses. Yes? I don't know whether you found that as well. You sort of go Adam, Noah, and it's sort of manageable. Abraham, and we'll get to that in a second, and it's sort of a bit bigger because you've got to scoop all the Adam and Noah stuff up, and it's you can kind of keep your head around it. Then you get to Moses, and it's like, okay, because it really is vast swathes of material. And so I tried to summarize some of those details in your handout under the heading, "We have a problem." I don't know how helpful that was, but we will try to pick up any questions you've got. We may not do anything much more than skim through other things. And part of the reason for this is I want to respond to some of the feedback that you've given about. So some of the material we've been looking at is familiar. We can always look in more detail at things, but I'd rather leave more of our time for the reading, which is in the second half of this course, most of which will be completely unfamiliar to you. At the same time, I don't want to presume too much of a theological foundation, because I know, apart from anything else, we come from different churches. I know what I've taught the people at All Saints, if they were paying attention, and most of them seem to be. But I don't know what you guys have had from your pastors in recent years. So I crave your patience if you're thinking, yeah, he said this in a sermon 3 weeks ago, kind of what's new? Yeah, sorry about that, but I'm trying to bring everybody up to speed. And we will be getting up to a higher speed at some point quite soon. So let me lead us in prayer, and then we'll pick up chapter 4, maybe do chapters 4 and 5 this week. Let's pray. Merciful Father, thank you for this time you've been gracious to give us. Thank you for the glimpses we're seeing, however faintly, of the plan that you've been working out throughout the whole of history, of which we are privileged to be heirs, to live at the climax of history, this period of time in which Christ is enthroned and his kingdom is growing, and the promises about which we're reading have been and are being fulfilled. We ask, Father, that you'd help us to keep our minds on that big picture, even as we look in some of these details, and that we may with diligence and insight build on whatever it is that we know up to this point, so we're able to understand more fully and deeply your purposes in history and your purposes for our lives. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Somebody summarize for me what covenant theology is or does. Yeah.
So it would be that the study of the covenants of God, whether it be the Abraham, a Moses, or even the new covenant that we have learned and that Jesus has brought. I think it's like the more in-depth study of those specifically.
Yeah, very good.
The promises that God has made to his people.
Very good. How do the different covenants relate to each other? Who's got a squeaky chair, by the way? Is it you? You can change it if you want. I mean, or we can all dance to the music of the... Yeah, it's one of those folding ones, isn't it? Let's not sit on that. How do the different covenants relate to each other? Yeah, JL.
They all kind of like build on each other.
Right, very good. They all build on each other. Can you give me an example of that? It's a harder question. Yeah?
So, I know this is a big jump, but let's say from when Noah is given permission to eat the animals of the land, like all the way to when Peter is given the permission to eat the unclean food.
Okay.
I know it's a big jump, but those are kind of like related.
Yes, there's a theme in the Bible that I've never spent time exploring. You could tell the whole story of the Bible simply by describing the historical development of what you're allowed to eat. Think about that for 1 second.
Theology next year is
looking
through the Bible and what to eat, not eat.
Well, how would you do it? Think of biblical history as consisting of successive connected chunks called covenantal eras or something. So you start with Adam in the garden. What are you allowed to do? What can you eat?
Everything.
Anything, like, just don't eat that. It's like, face palm. The one thing you're not supposed to do. So the whole problem with humanity is they eat the wrong things. And then they're cast out of the garden, so they can't eat anything in the garden now. So the judgment consists in something which is related to the sin. You ate the wrong thing, you're not having anything now. And when you try and grow crops to eat, what kind of plants would you get growing up? Thorns and thistles. Have fun eating those, unless you're Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Do you know what I mean? Right? Okay, so, but nonetheless, God feeds them, you know, because the land does produce at least some stuff, right? And then covenant with Noah. Who's mentioned Noah yet? Isaiah. Somebody else tell us what's different when God... When we move from Adam to Noah, what does God say? It's different. Yeah.
You can eat meat?
Yeah, you can eat meat now.
Only certain kinds of meat?
Yeah, only certain kinds of meat. Well, yeah, maybe only certain kinds of meat. The only certain kinds thing becomes much clearer in the era of who? Abraham, Moses, or David?
Moses.
Why?
Because they can't eat unclean animals.
Right, exactly. So one of the things that distinguishes, no, yes, okay, that'll do for now. One of the things that distinguishes them as a people is they don't eat certain things. And it's all related to the need to maintain holiness and cleanliness so they can come near to God in the tabernacle. And if you were at Bible study last night, yes, so it's like God has put in place this temporary system of Torah to keep you out of the sanctuary, but you can kind of come close-ish, and this is like a schoolmaster, it's like training you, but you still can't eat everything yet. And that not eating everything is like an echo of the Garden of Eden. You can't eat the stuff that's in the garden, yeah? Scroll them. David doesn't really introduce many changes to the eating thing, because they're supposed to be faithful to the law of Moses. Jesus comes along, and Mark chapter 7. What happens in Mark chapter 7? That's related to this issue of eating. Yeah.
Eating on the Sabbath?
Not quite. Let's grab Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7, the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, and they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. And so there's a big bust-up about where you're supposed to wash your hands, and the Pharisees used to wash their hands and their plates and their bowls and their sofas and everything. And Jesus has this kind of argument with them. And then when he's finished with them, end of verse 13, he says, I'm done with you. Like, he gets all the crowd to come to him, verse 14, and says, hear me, all of you, and understand, there is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. Yeah? Obviously. Because the whole point of this food stuff, it's not like God didn't restrict you from eating certain food because the food is inherently evil. Like it's bringing evil into your beautiful, pure body. Yeah? He restricted you from doing that for all kinds of other reasons. And then you've got this, he explains it, verse 17, verse 18. End of verse 18. Whatever goes into a person from outside can't defile him, since it goes into his heart, not into his heart, but into his stomach, and is expelled. Jesus is very kind of subtle and dainty about some of that biological stuff. Thus he declared all foods clean. And we're all thinking, oh, great, that means we can have bacon sandwiches. No. Well, yes. I mean, that is quite important to be able to... And I've noticed in America, people don't eat bacon sandwiches, which is very disturbing to me. I suppose so. But in England, you just have bacon. No lettuce, no tomato or tomato.
Bacon and bread.
Bacon, lots of bacon. And this sauce called HP sauce. And HP stands for Houses of Parliament. And it's sort of spicy brown sauce. It's got a picture of the Houses of Parliament on it, which is a bit like the Congress building. Anyway, I don't know why. It's amazing sauce. And so you just eat bacon sandwiches for breakfast, which we can do because of Mark chapter 7. And everyone thinks, wonderful, we can eat brisket and that kind of thing. But that's not the reason that's good news is because for Jesus to declare all foods clean is to be viewed in the light of Genesis 1 to 3. It's like, sanctuary access has been granted. This is the end of the Mosaic restrictions. You can't go into the temple. You can't eat these foods. You can't mix these things together in the same field. You can't mix these cloths, these fabrics in the same garment, etc. It's the end of those restrictions which are designed to reflect the fact that you can't enter the holy presence of God. Now you can eat. In fact, you can eat me, Jesus says. Where does he say that? Oh dear. John chapter 6. Sorry, John chapter 6. Yes, that's right, John chapter 6. So not only now, with the coming of Christ, are you allowed to eat every food in all creation? You can even eat the bread that comes from outside of creation. Verse 51. You got that, John 6, 51? I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever, and the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. So you can eat that bread, and you have to. Verse 53, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life within you. So you have to eat Jesus. You have to eat. What?
I'm sorry.
You have to eat Jesus.
That's what it says.
I know, it's just...
I'm interpreting it literally. I know what it means.
I know you know what it means. I don't think I'm dealing... Of all the problems in all my Bible and theology classes, it's not the case that we have this lot of back row Catholics who are desperate to kind of introduce a doctrine of transubstantiation. You know, it's like that's... You know, we've had our moments, haven't we? But we haven't had that. Yeah. And so that means that when Jesus... when Peter is in Galatia, and Paul goes there and he's kind of hanging out with him, and Peter denies the gospel. Remember that in Galatians chapter 2? How does he deny the gospel? That's earlier. Peter doesn't have has a fairly checkered history, isn't he? In Galatians chapter 2, turn to Galatians chapter 2. Verse 11, he calls him Cephas. Why does he call him Cephas and not Petros? I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, but why does he call him that here? I've never thought. Anyway, I can't fix that now. But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. It may be your translation says he was clearly in the wrong. I mean, the match to the same thing. Like, condemned before God. Jeepers. What's he done that's, like, so wicked and evil that he's condemned before God? For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, those are Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, where James was. When they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. That's the group of Jewish Christians. The rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with them, so even Barnabas was led astray. What's the problem? It's that he won't eat with Gentiles. He's not willing to sit down with Gentiles and sort of risk contamination by their Gentile impurity at the dinner table.
Well, at least when the other Jews came.
Right. It's like he was... And it's clear that if when you look in Galatians and actually in Acts as well, it's clear that those other Jews were... Jewish Christians, sorry. They wanted to keep in place the dietary restrictions that existed in the days of Moses, which Jesus said, no, declared all foods clean. It's all good now. And Paul says, verse 14, look at this. When I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said, you a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How can... And he goes on and he criticizes it. So refusing to obey the command to eat everything with everybody, the whole body of Christ, is a denial of the gospel. Because what the gospel is a declaration that you can eat anything now. You never thought about that, did you? Excellent. So put that down to kind of one minor victory for the morning. We learned something. And how did you do that? What you did was, back to my opening question, it was an exercise in covenant theology. What you observed, rightly, was that the Bible describes an unfolding sequence of stages in God's relationship with his people. Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, returned from exile, probably. As in, there's probably something going on there that's a bit different from David. I don't know what. Jesus. And in each stage, you're, what is it that, was it Isaiah said or Seth said? You're building on the previous one, and it's developing what's happened before. So it tells a single unfolding story, and then you can trace through that matrix or that framework any one of 100,000 or a million different biblical themes. And you can see how that theme tells the story of what God is doing in the world. We just did it with what you're allowed to eat. I've never done that before. But once you see biblical history in that way, I could set you homework and ask you to do the same thing with relationships between brothers. How do relationships between big brother and little brother vary and develop during the Bible? Or rocks and mountains and trees? Or insects? Or wind? Or fire? Any number of objects and entities, but also little snapshots of scenes, like women giving birth to children. See how the theme of women giving birth to children develops through the Bible. Or the younger brother inheriting the father's estate. rather than the older brother. And that's a kind of subset of the relationship between the brothers thing. Right? Or husbands and wives. Trace the story of biblical history by looking at how the relationship between husbands and wives develops. Any one of a gazillion different objects, abstract concepts, types of event, types of relationship can be traced through the Bible one step at a time by perceiving that these eras, these covenantal eras, are like carriages in a train. They come one after the other and they're linked to each other, but there's development between them. One of my Old Testament professors way back even did this once with the theme of sweat. And those of you who are All Saints can remember me telling that story. So I won't. Don't look so mystified.
So,
yeah.
Because of sweat?
Yeah.
No, I just want to hear where you're coming from because I'm thinking
about it. So where? By the sweat of your brow you will eat bread till you return to the ground, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Where's that from?
Genesis.
Chapter like 3. So that's the curse on Adam, yes? So when Adam sweats, it's like, oh my goodness, this is the sweat of my face, which is the sign of hard work, which is going to end in me dying. It's work that's cursed and frustrating and painful. Ever had to, you know, break up a concrete patio and shovel the concrete in blocks in a pallet truck or something out to the front to put it in a dumpster? Ever had to do that? Okay. At least two of you have, right? You know, it's hard work. Ever had to do theology homework that was like a bit boring or a bit difficult? No. It's always been unalloyed joy. Ever had to do Greek homework that was... Right, there we are. I'm so glad I'm not your Greek teacher. There we are. That's good. I'm glad. Right, so work is frustrating, and the sign that it's frustrating is sweat.
Isn't it?
Go on.
I was just saying, when you said sweat, it also immediately reminded me of how Jesus sweat blood on the cross.
Oh, that's the third instance of the word sweat in the Bible. There's one other. In Ezekiel 40, I want to say 43, but I might be wrong. The prophet sees a vision of the new temple, and he's told that in it the priests may not wear anything that causes them to sweat. So you can't wear wool or anything. You have to wear linen garments. Why would you not want to do that? Well, you don't go bringing your cursed work into the temple. This is blessed work. Yeah? That's why... I mean, there's a practical reason why priests, who've got all that kind of ornate embroidered fabric, it's got to be made of linen. Because if it's ornate and embroidered and it's made of wool, it's like, he wants to be a priest. It's really, because it's hot in Israel. In a tent, especially, it's going to be hot. But so if you wear linen, it's kind of lighter and you won't sweat so much. But what matters more is the symbolism of sweat. That you don't want to bring the sign of cursed work into the holy place. And so the third occurrence of sweat in the Bible is what Seth said, which is where?
I don't remember the exact passage, but it was Christ's crucifixion.
Yeah, Gethsemane, before Jesus is crucified, his sweat became like great drops of blood falling on the ground. Why? Right. It's not, commentators spend forever trying to figure out what's the name of that disease where you become so anxious and your blood pressure rises so much that the blood vessels under your skin burst. And I can't forget what it's called. It can happen perhaps if you have severely bruised tissue or if you have acutely high blood pressure. I think it can happen. That the blood vessels under your skin burst and they mix with the sweat in the sweat glands and you actually bleed through your sweat glands. But that's not, I mean, presumably Jesus was under a fair amount of emotional strain at that point. Maybe his blood pressure was high. Maybe that's what happened. But the point that Luke makes in his account of that is this is cursed work that he's now in. Because the curse that God pronounced on Adam is being borne by Christ in our place. So there you are. That was Thomas Rentz. Now, he's actually returned to the college where I studied, Oak Hill in London, as the Old Testament professor. So you see what we're doing? Covenant theology is that unfolding story. Why are we talking about that in an eschatology course? Right? Just leading up to the coming of Christ?
And beyond.
And beyond. And normally when people say eschatology, what do they mean? They normally mean just the last bit. It's like, let's read the last chapter of this book. If you like. I want to read the previous 15 chapters first, if that's okay. Because then I'll understand the last chapter. Otherwise, if I just jump into chapter 16, I'll have all kinds of crazy ideas like rapture and, you know, etc. Don't want to do that. Yeah.
I'm also reminded of Galatians 3, verse 15 and 16.
Yeah, go on.
Where Paul basically, well, I'll just read it. To give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and his offspring. Does not say, and he goes on.
Yeah.
Basically, the idea that covenants aren't annulled, they're continuous. And they're
right. Very good. Unless there is a built-in expiry, you know, the Lord isn't going to kind of break his promises. And so what you find, this is neatly segueing to one of the questions I was asked. What you find again and again at different stages of history is that the living God makes reference to previous stages of history, previous covenants, previous eras, when he takes the step into the next one. So, you've looked at Abraham and Moses, yeah? Chapters 4 and 5 in this handout. Just turn to Exodus chapter 2. What's happening in Exodus chapter 2 birth of Moses, yeah, keep going. Yeah.
And then God hears Israel's groaning.
Yeah. End of read the last three verses, verses 23 to 25, if you would please, Toby.
During those many days the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. They cried for rescue from slavery to Mount God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew.
Right. Now, I think it was Anne. No, it wasn't Anne. It was Madeline. Hello, Madeline. Asked, in the ESV, the last sentence of that three verses is, God saw the people of Israel, and he knew. What is it that he knew? Well, here's the story. We've had, so Genesis 12, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 tribes. This takes us to the end of Genesis, yes? Transition from Genesis to Exodus, basically the end of Genesis, they go to which country? Egypt. Guys, come on. They go to Egypt. I've written it on the board. Like, so Exodus, oh dear, I can't write today. They're in the book of Exodus, they're in Egypt, and then Joseph dies, and the new king arises, and he's like, don't like these Israelites, so he enslaves them, there's too many of them. And everyone's like, oh, this is horrible, throw all the baby boys into the Nile, ah, that's horrible. God raises up Moses, who's in beginning of chapter 2. And then you get this little statement here. And it says, God saw the... Well, it doesn't actually say God saw. It says at the end, God heard their groans because of their slavery. And he remembered his covenant with Abraham and with Isaac and Jacob. Yeah? Can you see what's happening? This next phase, the phase that Moses begins, is initiated by God remembering the previous phase. Now think very carefully about this. Some of you have encountered at various times dispensational theology or dispensationalism. Hands up if you've heard that phrase. Only people at All Saints who I've warned about it. Okay, that's fine. And a couple of other people. One of the distinctive features of dispensational theology is that it chops up biblical history into chunks that aren't related to each other. It's more complex than that. One of the obvious problems with it is that the Bible doesn't do that. The Bible doesn't say, okay, we're done with Abraham now. That's in the past. Something completely new. What it says is, it's more subtle than that. What the Bible says is, remember that stuff from Abraham? Okay. It's time to get to work to bring to fulfillment what I promised back there. This promise, this covenant with Abraham, is the thing that God acts on here. Put it another way. The covenant through Moses is a fulfillment of the covenant with Abraham. You see, it's the same story. Which is how come you can trace the Bible story by thinking about bread and sweat and rocks and what you eat and women having babies and fights between brothers. Because it's all a single continuous story. Yes? Simon.
This could be completely off, I don't know. But does the word for and God knew, is that kind of relation to Genesis 3:5 and 4:1 as we talked about earlier about knowing or coming in contact?
Yeah. Well, this is the question that Madeline asked. So let's just think about that. I want to pick up that phrase from here. And God knew. Do you want to rephrase your question for us, Madeline, that you asked about this?
What is it that he knew? And is this, I mean, God can't gain knowledge that he doesn't already have. So is this a remembrance of something, and if it was, how could God forget?
Right, because it says remembered as well, doesn't it? Uh-huh. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God knew. So your puzzle is, had God forgotten? Is God like clueless and now he's, I forgot about Abraham. must remember. 400 years, my goodness, what a long time. No. What's actually happening here?
It is through the finite means, our finite capacity, this is one way we can understand God's faithfulness to his people. And God knew. It is almost reminiscent of how Adam and Eve knew that they were naked and knew that kind of sin, but this kind of knew is different. It is a shown of their faithfulness rather than their rebellion.
Yeah.
This sin, perhaps. A little bit of speculative speculation.
We use the word know in a couple of different ways. And it depends on what the object is. If the object is facts or information, it's just like I'm cognitively aware of that. Yeah? I know, because I can dimly remember, elementary quantum mechanics. Right? I know how to multiply 6 by 6 and get 36. Right? We know those facts. I know that the capital of England is London. and that London and Scotland are not the same place. And what is the difference between Wales and the United Kingdom? Quite a lot. You know, I know... You know, please explain. No, no. So we can know facts. It's just like information. But if I said, I know Seth, what's different about that? Let's get Toby jumping, go on.
Well, like, those are like straight facts that you know, but if you know Seth, you know, like, his qualities or the things he likes to do, it's less factual. You have to spend time with him to know him. Mm-hmm. You could just read a book and know all that stuff.
Right, right. But I could, but just let me press that. Like, all those things that what he likes and what he does and how he talks, I could read a book about that as well, couldn't I? I could have this, the Book of Seth. That says, Seth is a charming young man, quite measured in his speech, short dark hair, likes smoked brisket and black coffee, doesn't like Earl Grey tea. Got to Texas as soon as he could, but wasn't born here. You know, those are still facts. What's the difference between knowing facts about Seth and knowing Seth? Go on.
Again, is it coming in contact with, like, I mean, you could read a book about Seth, but until you talk to Seth or spend time with him, you don't know him. You don't know him. It's a relationship.
Yeah. Yes. Go on.
Well, you could also read a book about a city, but until you're there, you don't really know what it's like.
Yeah, until you've been to London and felt the vibration of the streets under your feet when the tube train goes past and the peculiar kind of shimmer of the lights of Leicester Square in the wet pavements, because they're always wet pavements, sidewalks, pavements. Yeah. Until you've been there, you don't know. Yeah, there's kind of experiential... Well, you all want to go to London now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
All expenses
paid. All expenses paid by whom? Because obviously... And this is the thing that always makes me smile. All expenses paid. Well, obviously, all expenses will be paid. But by whom? Like, by somebody else.
By right.
Right. That's normally what it means. All expenses paid by anyone but me. So until it's experiential relational knowledge. Adam knew his wife Eve. Yeah? It's relational closeness. It's... They knew that they were naked. It's not as, oh my goodness, I've got no clothes on. That's a bit awkward. I wondered why I was cold. I noticed that. It's not that. It's like they suddenly had this shattering realization that it's not that they look. It's not that the information had changed. They knew that they were naked before, but they knew that this was a problem in the sense that what they wanted to do was hide themselves. They felt exposed for the first time. And not before each other, but before God. They're not getting fig leaves so that she can't see me. No. They're hiding themselves from God. Hiding among the trees. And God's walking in the trees, among the trees of the garden in the cool of the day. Yeah? And so they kind of make themselves look like trees. Like, God will never see me. Yeah, mistake. So... To know somebody or to know an experience is to have that kind of visceral contact with it. And so God saw the people of Israel. What were the people of Israel doing?
Groaning because of being
enslaved. Yeah, and God knew. He's like, yeah, I feel for you all here in Texas. And I know that you want to go to England, really. And so I've promised that I'll pay an all expenses paid trip for you all to come to London. And I see your misery and your groaning here in Texas, and I know. And so I'm going to fulfill, I remember my promise that I made, and I'm now going to act upon it.
Can we just get you to write that down?
He's
exposed.
He said, quote, just as an illustration of the theological point. Can you see what God's doing there?
He was recording.
I'm recording it. parents, just for the sake of clarity, this was a pure illustration, not intended to communicate any actual... Anyway, can you see what's happening there? Go ahead, Madeline.
So then, if we're talking about knowing London is to be there, how can God know there's slavery if he's never been?
Yeah, so it's not like... You know, knowing London is like... Okay, backtrack. Knowing London is like being there, experiencing it. Knowing somebody in their suffering is like feeling the kind of sympathy for them that would make you want to act on their behalf. So you know things in different ways. That's the point I'm getting at. Yeah, Isaiah.
That's also limiting God to human factors too. Whenever some say that because God, I think, knows everything. So he would know how slavery feels, even though he's never been in slavery because he's God.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of on that note, couldn't you say that since God is outside of time, Jesus, who had suffered, is kind of complicated, in human form, and he had suffered, like, just things on earth, mm-hmm. that he could sympathize to that?
Yes. God knows what it's like to be a man. Just think about that for a second. God knows what it's like to be a man. And so he has access, both because he's the creator, he has access to our experiences just because he upholds and brings about our experiences. But he also knows what it means to be on the receiving end of them as man. So yes, the danger is this gets really complicated. I'll try and simplify it. That's one of the reasons why history is all about Christ. And because what history presupposes is the incarnation of Christ. If Adam hadn't sinned and the devil hadn't rebelled, would God still have become man? Hands up if you think definitely not. Okay, hands up if you think, I'm not sure. Yeah, good. Hands up if you think, yeah, I reckon so.
Maybe.
There's a debate about this, okay, among theologians. Most people think, probably. And some people think, yeah, definitely. And I think, pretty much definitely. And the reason is because the incarnation accomplishes more than just dealing with sin and overcoming evil. If Adam hadn't sinned and there'd been no devil to conquer, there would still have been a job to do for the incarnate Son of God. Yeah, but imagine if there weren't. Imagine if the devil had been like a good angel and Adam and Eve had been faithful. Would God have still become man? Well, if you can think of anything that becoming man would have accomplished in those circumstances, then the answer might be yes. Does God becoming man accomplish anything? Yes, it means that God experiences creation from the inside. So yes, probably, Charlie, which then comes back to your question, which is a question not just about Exodus 2, 23 to 25. It's a question about the whole architecture of covenant theology. What God is doing at every stage of this transition, from one era to the next, is scooping up things from the past and transforming them and reformulating them and taking them to the next stage. And so you're very familiar with this because you find all kinds of quotations from the Older Testament in the New Testament. Yeah? When Peter on the day of Pentecost, think of last Sunday, you guys are All Saints, Peter on the day of Pentecost is preaching and he gets to the end of the sermon and everyone's kind of anguished because they realize they just crucified the Messiah, which was probably a bad idea from their point of view. And they say, brothers, what should we do? And he says, well, repent and be baptized, etc., etc., for the promises for you and for your children. And he's quoting from Genesis 17. Because what he wants to highlight is, if we had a really, really wide whiteboard, I'd write it kind of 20 yards over there somewhere. He's wanting to highlight that what Peter is promising through the Spirit in the age of the church is the fulfillment of what God promised to Abraham in Genesis 17. So he quotes from Genesis 17 to make that point. Yeah.
Well,
Okay, let me pause there. Can you see what we've done so far? We've had a bit of a break, inter-semester break, mid-term break. Then we had a conversation last week about some other stuff. And then you've been catching up with all this Abraham, Moses stuff. And what I wanted to highlight is not so much many particular details of that, though we picked up one, end of Exodus 2, but how the whole story fits together into a single historical big picture. With me? All happy so far? And what actually happens in the days of Moses, back to what I mentioned right at the beginning, is rather than being like a timeline, like this, Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus, etc. Rather than being like that, it's more like a snowplow. Have you ever seen a snowplow? But a really badly designed one. A really good snowplow is like this, and it will push the snow out of the way, maybe all onto one side of the road or both sides of the road. But if you had a badly designed snowplow, it would be like a scoop like this. And as you're going along the road, it would just be scooping up all the snow, and it's kind of mounding up in front of it. And you get to Moses, and you hit a massive snow drift, basically. It's like, and you have this. You go from having a sort of manageable amount of snow in front of you, Adam, Noah, bit of Abraham. You hit Moses, it's like, and you've got like a Mount Everest, and you're trying to kind of push this thing along in front of your snowplow. That's what covenant theology does. It scoops up all the events of history as God is working through history. And Moses just basically, it multiplies by a factor of about 100 the amount of data that we've got to take account of. So instead of 50 chapters in Genesis, it's about 500, yeah? So I'm sorry, about 10 times, not 100 times. But the interconnections between all those parts mean that it's not just like 10 times more complicated. There's so much more material to deal with, yeah? So, section 4, the covenant with Abraham, and section 5, the covenant with Moses. Let's try and just summarize as briefly as we can the Abraham bit, then pick up any detailed questions, then summarize the Moses bit, and pick up any detailed questions, and see if we can get through all of that in half an hour. That'd be funny. Right. Somebody want to summarize what God does in and through the covenant with Abraham? Genesis 12, 15, 17. If you can't summarize it, just throw some ingredients in, and then we'll see if we can stir it up into the pot. And go on, Simon.
He makes it so that not only the house of Israel can part of the covenant, so people outside of Israel.
Right. Very good. So it's not just Israelites. Well, Israel sort of doesn't exist yet, does it? Israel is the name that is given to this guy, Jacob, and his offspring. But it's not just Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, their offspring, is it? How do you know that? Which text? Well, there's lots of texts, but which?
Verse
19. Go on. Genesis 17? 17, verse 19.
God said, "No, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I'll establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him."
Right. So it's Abraham, Isaac, plus offspring, but where does it say other nations? Is that what you said?
Verse 11?
Yeah.
And through 14?
Go on, read that to us.
"You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money, from any foreigner who is not of your offspring. Both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised."
Okay, very good. So anybody who's in the household. Track back to Genesis 12. Somebody read Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3.
"And the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make
of you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I'll curse, and the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Right, very good. You see that last bit of verse 3? Let's just, can you shut the door for us, Jack? Thank you. Verse 3. In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
When Pastor Shaw was here, he said that that's a reference to the seed of the woman and how that expands to all people.
Yeah, very good. All the families of the earth. Interestingly, let's flick on to Genesis 22. This is not a text I gave you to look at, I think, was it? Oh, no, it does. I did mention this. In that, a sub-point of the Genesis 17 section. How does Genesis 22, verses 15 to 19, shed light on this? Does it say the same thing?
It says, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies.
Yes.
Which is different than...
And it says, in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed.
And yeah. 19. In your offspring, your seed, which Galatians 3 says is talking about a singular seed. Whether you notice that? Shall all the, literally, nations, I think it probably says this in your text, nations of the earth shall be blessed. If you look at Genesis 12:3, it says something slightly different.
Bless you, him who exerts a curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Yeah, you need to do some Hebrew. I'm sorry I didn't mention this to you, but if you'd looked up at commentaries, you would have noticed that it doesn't say families of the earth, it says families of the land. Now, there's a difference between families in the land and nations of the earth. What's the difference? Right.
Families are smaller, they're more particular.
Right.
Nations filling the whole earth.
Families, it's like, well, you know, a bunch of families. There's your family and my family and the Claghorn family and the Brandt family and the Husted family and your family. And nations are like, okay, that's bigger. Land is one little piece. Earth is the whole shebang. Notice what's happening. Even within this era of Abraham, you're seeing development in what God is promising. He starts off by saying, all the families of the land, all the little clans, literally, it's mishpachot, it's extended families, you know, the extended Rozier family, you know, your dad and mum and all their brothers and sisters and cousins and uncles, you know, this kind of Rozier clan, yes? All those clans in this land. But by the time you get to Genesis chapter 22, God says, no, it's not just families in this land, it's nations on this earth. Yeah, Jael. Well, if the Moses project had worked, then yes. Because remember Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 to 8. Have you read Deuteronomy 4 recently? Is it on here? About how you're supposed to show all the other nations of the world how wonderful that, yeah? So if that worked well, yes. But there's a couple of other things that have happened between Genesis 12 and Genesis 22. What's just happened in Genesis 22?
sacrifice.
Where? Which mountain? Are you looking at notes in your study Bible? Oh, look at you.
The closest city, it says, is Salem.
Yeah, that's right. Which is short for... What's Salem part of the name of? Hey, Isaiah.
Yes. Oh, Jerusalem.
No, it's like, have you ever played Hangman? You know, you've got to fill the letters, yeah. Right? Jerusalem. Where Melchizedek was king and priest. And what's just happened is that Abraham has nearly sacrificed his son on a mountain near Jerusalem.
Land of Moria.
Moriah. It's the mount. It's not the land of Moria. So predictable, Lord of the Rings references. And now what you do is, because what you always do when you're reading the Bible is you think, I've read that, I don't need to read it again. Then you think, no, I probably should read it again, because that'd be a good idea. You go back to verse 15. The angel of the Lord calls to Abraham a second time from heaven, and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord. In other words, like, I really mean it this time. And he meant it before, but I really mean it. Because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and the sand that is on the seashore. So they'll become many, many, numerous people. Your offspring shall possess the gate of their enemies. That is, anybody who stands opposed to this multinational community will eventually be overthrown. Your offspring, singular, will possess the gate of his enemies. Every knee will bow, eventually. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because what?
You've obeyed my voice.
Yeah, you've done what you're told. You've sacrificed your, well, nearly sacrificed your son. So what you really need, if what you want is for all the nations of the earth to be blessed, you need to find somebody who's going to sacrifice his son on Mount Moriah, don't you? Especially if he's only got one son, like your only son. Hold on a second. Yeah? Yeah. So now just think for a second. This kind of covenant theology story, the plot thickens. Not only is it sort of gradual progress from creation forwards, yeah? And not only is it not just a kind of a single line, but it's expanding like this, right? You know, you get Adam, Noah, Abraham, you think you're keeping up, and then you get Moses, and it starts to go wild, and then David, and then Jesus. There's more of it. But what you start to notice is that there are patterns. Hold on a second, Simon, I see your hand. You start to notice that there are patterns in the story which repeat themselves. There's this little pattern where there's a guy who has to sacrifice his son on top of a mountain, and then all the nations will be blessed. That's a neat little pattern. There's another guy who's sacrificed on a mountain. Actually, probably not on a mountain. Outside the city. Everyone says it's on a hill. Like, there is a green hill far away without a city wall where our dear Lord was crucified. It doesn't say in the Bible that he was crucified on a hill. Go and read the Bible. It doesn't say. It might have been in a valley. Everyone says, oh, it's Golgotha, which is the place of the skull. So what we imagine is this kind of really big, kind of monstrous cliff, and he's on top. And it's like, it might have been a valley with skulls in it. I mean, I don't, anyway. But it's outside the city, which is on a mountain. So we're going to store him out here. And then all the nations of the world find blessing. Yeah, you see patterns. The name for the study of these patterns is typology. You heard that word before? Okay, you have now. We say that this is a type. Oops. And this is an anti actually, I think it's anti. Is it anti with an E? I forget. Yeah, I think that's right. Anti-type. So anti means before, so it wouldn't be that. Yeah, this is the anti-type. So you've heard people say that Boaz is a type of Christ. Yes, you must have heard that. David is a type of Christ. You think, what do you mean type of Christ? You'd like some kind of Christ or something? Yeah, kind of, but type in the sense of typology. The word comes from tupos, which I think means the impression that is left in a soft material by like a seal or a ring, yeah, some kind of insignia. I think that's what it means. I don't recall. So I don't quote me on that. Check with Mr. Bauer, make sure I'm getting it right. But this is like a replica in advance of this. And we already did this with other... Well, you see other elements in biblical history where what you see in the life of David is similar to what you see in the life of Jesus and so on and so forth. So notice you have two related things going on at the same time. You've got multiple storylines weaving their way through the Bible. Sweat and what we eat and mountains and so on. These continuous storylines. And then alongside those, you've got little repeating events, patterns in history. And it's these storylines plus the repeated events that give, I want to say literary coherence, but it's kind of thematic coherence to the unfolding story of the Bible. You with me? So Abraham, it's all the earth. How many people? Lots of people. Where are they going to live? Yeah. No, where's Abraham and his family going to live, according to Genesis 12? Yeah, in the land of Canaan. They promised lots of people. They promised the land. And they're also promised God's blessing.
Not just any land, it's the land of the other nations.
Yeah, it's the land of Canaan. Yeah. And then that land, well, it becomes a picture of what's going to happen to all the nation. Yeah? Okay. So that's Abraham. And I asked you to look at Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17. Any questions lingering about those chapters in your minds? Because I'd love to get on to Moses and just kind of move swiftly through that, because you've read the text, you've answered the questions and so on. All happy? So Moses, so what happens in the days of Moses then? What's new? Oh goodness, yes, that's complicated. Who wants to have a go at summarizing the Moses era for us? Much harder. Instead of three verses or sort of three chapters, you've got quite a lot of material to go with. What's the new thing that happens in the era of Moses? Yeah, Hannah. Yes, very good. Let's do it down here, shall we? So, the Exodus. Escaping from Egypt. Very good. What else is new?
lots of things.
Lots of things.
To begin with, you could do.
Lots.
I mean, like, there's lots.
Okay, so.
To begin with, you got in the new covenant made with him, he's got promise of milk and honey in the new land. You've got the promise of bounties of and the relationship with the other nations that you will eventually be fulfilled to be to fill the earth with all the nations as they come together under the covenant. And after that, they also make this tabernacle thing.
Tabernacle thing.
The house of God. And there's no other connection.
There's a tabernacle thing. What's the tabernacle for? Sorry, Simon, you had your hand up earlier and I didn't come back to you.
It was completely different and you already explained it.
All right, fine. Okay, good. Toby, you had your hand up. Remind me.
Tabernacle.
You're going to say the tabernacle thing as well. So what was the tabernacle exactly?
It was God's house and a place for offerings.
Right? Now, what questions did I ask you about the tabernacle? Where were we? Oh, yeah. Did you all read Exodus 26 to 31 and then 36 to 40 in detail, painstakingly going through verse by... No, you didn't, because I just said consider it, didn't I? I didn't ask you to read it in detail. You did read it. What if you did read it? That's good. What can you tell me about the tabernacle?
It is ornated with things that are reminiscent of the garden.
Bingo. Just say that again, because I think some people were talking about something else. Go on.
The tabernacle is decorated with things reminiscent of the garden.
Like?
Like pomegranates and trees and leaves and stuff like that.
Right. Exactly. See, it's so worth coming to Wednesday night Bible study because you might learn something. So it's got trees, pomegranates. It's got one particular tree-shaped thing. Lampstand, candelabra. Yeah, and only one lampstand, seven branches, and they're called branches, and the things on the end are called, flowers and calyxes, and the calyx is the little bit underneath the bud of a flower in some trees, and they're made like almond blossoms. So it's a burning tree. Hold on. Burning?
Whoa!
No, not a burning tree.
So the tabernacle contains a burning tree, which coincidentally we had a burning tree back here, but the tabernacle is also just like not just like, but in some ways like, the Garden of Eden back here. Because tree, water, doesn't mention birds. Very interestingly, it doesn't, I mean it doesn't Genesis 1, but it doesn't really mention. Anyway, maybe come back to that. What else has it got standing outside it? Go on, fiery sword. Fiery sword angel thing called a... Well, the two of them.
Angel?
Cherubim. Cherubim. Right? Fiery sword angel thing. Fiery sword angel thing. Somebody who was at Bible study last night, do this next bit for me. The fiery sword angel thing is a bit like what?
It's a bit like the... spirit?
Was it? Probably. Mrs. Claghorn, come on, help us out. I haven't got time for you kids. Let's just talk to the adults.
Sorry.
Come on. Right? The cherubim at the entrance to the... The cherubim at the entrance... You've got to think. Just use literary imagination like Mrs. Claghorn is showing you how to do. The cherubim at the end of Genesis 3, fire, sword, burning. What colours? Orange and red. Look in the centre of a flame, what do you see?
Yellow.
Blue. Yeah, yellow. Right. So on the inside of the tabernacle, you've got this oil lamp, orangey-yellow light, and the inside curtains have these cherubim embroidered on the inside. What colour fabric? blue and gold, reflecting two other colors, purple, scarlet. Look, Exodus 26. Look, you all read this. Oh, no, you didn't read it. You considered it because I let you off having to read it. Exodus 26. You shall make, verse 1, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen. By the way, linen. The tabernacle is made of linen. The priest wears linen. Log that away because you're going to need it in about 2 minutes. Blue and purple and scarlet, and you shall make them with cherubim skillfully worked into them. So just think what it looked like on the inside of this tent. Inside of the tent, oil lamp, orangey light, cherubim in embroidery of blue, purple, scarlet with bits of gold thread, it says later on. So they looked like they're kind of burning because that's all the colours of fire that you see, yes? So inside the tabernacle and actually on the curtain that separates the most holy place from the holy place, you've also got cherubim embroidered there, like, get out of here, you're not allowed to come in. They are like replicas of this guy, the burning, fiery sword people, angel things, who are outside the Garden of Eden to stop you coming in. Excellent. Who else looks like this? Oh, I told you. I should have said, what else? I've made it so easy now. Who else looks like blue and purple and scarlet yarn? Right. Flip over the page, chapter 28. Linen, yeah? He's made of the same stuff the tabernacle's made of. And I'm not going to read. Chapter 28, verses 1 to 5 is the description of the clothes for Aaron the priest and for his successors. Verse 5, they shall receive gold, blue, purple, scarlet yarns and fine twined linen. That's what their clothes are made of. So they look like the cherubim on the inside of the tabernacle, which also looked like the cherubim on the outside of the Garden of Eden, because the priest's job is to do what the cherubim did, which is fire, sword. What's going to happen to you if you come near the cherubim? How? Stabbed, chopped up into bits, and burned. So what happens if you come near the priest outside the tabernacle? Stab, burn. But you don't want to get stabbed, chopped into bits and set on fire, do you? So what do you do instead? Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, and at this point the tabernacle has just been constructed, the presence of God has arrived in the tabernacle at the end of the book of Exodus, yeah? They can't go in because God is in there. They don't want to go in there because God's in there. It'd be really scary. The Lord then goes, Moses! I'm like, what? Who is that? That's me. And the Lord called Moses and said, verse 2, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, look, if you come here and it's just you, then you're going to get chopped into pieces and set on fire and we wouldn't want that. So what should you do? Bring something else to be chopped into pieces and set on fire instead of you. Duh! It's like, that's such a good idea. So I need a volunteer. So we need one of us needs to be an animal and the other one needs to kill it.
Okay, I'll be the animal.
No, I'll be the animal, right? Okay, don't kill me. Right? But so what happens is, so you need to find some way of identifying me as your animal. So how about this? Verse 4 will help you. Go on. Verse 4. Everyone listen.
Oh, man, you have so many markings. Where's verse 4?
It's just before verse 5. Right. It's that yellow bit, the bit that's highlighted.
Right.
He shall lay.
Okay, there it is. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him.
Right, just listen to that. Listen really carefully. It shall be accepted for him,
to make atonement
for him. So if he doesn't want to get chopped into pieces and set on fire, he needs to tell God which animal to kill instead. How's he going to do that? There's all these cows and goats and sheep and people, you know, and stuff. How do we know which one is his? Go on.
Put my hand on his head.
It's like that. That's it. Right? And so now the priest is like, great, now we know. Now God knows. Thank you. You can sit down, everybody. Round of applause for Seth. That's so brilliant. Yeah, awesome. Now God knows which animal to kill instead of Seth. It's really handy because Seth is like, whew. So we kill the goat or the sheep or whatever, and we do all the kind of stuff with the blood, and then we set the thing on fire. What happens to something when you set it on fire? Barbecue? Genesis 6? No. Genesis 8. Sorry. God smelled the pleasing aroma of Noah's sacrifice. Oh, goodness. What? Pleasing aroma? Here's another thing from back here that you get here. Pleasing aroma. So that's nice. What else happens when you burn something? Let's suppose it goes a bit beyond the barbecue stage and kind of keeps going. No. You leave it on the grill. It turns to ash. And what else?
It smokes.
Where does the smoke go?
Into the air.
Right. Well, not quite into heaven. Because there's another cloud of smoke.
That's also burning.
Was it when Moses was leading the Egyptians out and the Lord provided a pillar of fire, and then at night it was just smoke?
But then at night they could see the fire. That's right. And that's the cloud that's the presence of God that descends on the tabernacle. And that they keep it there by keeping incense burning. So there's always smoke that represents the presence of God. And when you burn the animal that represents you, it goes up and mingles with... It's like God eats the animal. The smoke from the animal is taken up into God. Yes? And that's the system that Moses put in place, God put in place through Moses, to temporarily deal with the fact that little Johnny Israelite and little Jenny Israelite are not allowed to go back in there. Not allowed to go in. What you can do is you can have this kind of replica garden, like a portable Garden of Eden tent, tabernacle, that you can take with you wherever you go, and instead of you getting chopped into bits and set on fire when you go near it, we'll do it with an animal instead. How's that? That's kind of nice, isn't it? Excellent. Which is all very well until you're settled in the land and you need something a bit more permanent. It'll be like you want to have, instead of a tent, you want to have a building. Temple, for example. But we're out of time. So we'll have to do that next week. Okay, so you've all got loads and loads of questions about Moses, but that's okay. You can answer them next year or get Mr. Bauer to tell you the answer to them. For next week, you're going to go in and read Section 6, David and Israel's Monarchy. And then we'll come back and carry on the rip-roaring story of whatever it is that the living God is doing in the world that we're discovering this week. Right, let's pray, and then you can go. Merciful Father, thank you again for your goodness to us, opening our eyes to so many things, for the intricacy and interconnectedness of your word, the Bible. And we ask that you'd help us to grow in our appreciation of the coherence of the plan you have for us and for the whole world, and therefore of your faithfulness to it. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, everybody. Have a lovely rest of your day, and I will see you either on Sunday, which is next week, or next Thursday.